the Time of Awakening Conference at Mackinac Island, beautiful Grand Hotel. I am so pleased to be back to the BBS audience for a second time. This time I will be talking to the attendees here about the shift again of 2012, but this time instead of focusing upon the metaphysical and inner shift, I will be looking also at aspects of the planetary shift rather than the shift of the people of the planet into a new world, a new heaven, and a new earth. 2012 is a number to be reckoned with these days. It is all over the internet. Many books have been written about it, and it is almost a kind of buzzword. Has achieved a kind of cult status in that dubious portion of our cultural milieu that has to do with the buzz, what's happening now, what's hot. And yet, it isn't just the fad, it's not just the buzz. It is a date to be reckoned with from many sources that has been rejected as a date of a tremendous shift in planetary consciousness and a shift in the entire planet itself, physically. The date of 2012 has been coincidentally reckoned by several different sources as the apex or the occurrence or the exact moment of a shift from life as we know it into something else. That something else can be the end of the world as we know it or the beginning of a whole new world, depending on the source. For the Mayans, it was an ending and a beginning. And it was not arrived at by any mythological means or by the hazard of a guess. It was part of a very complex and wonderful ancient system of measurement of time. To the Mayans, the calendar that they used was divided into weeks, 20 weeks. It was divided into months of 20 days. And these 20 days added up to a year of 360 days. And then there was a five-day interval before the next year of 360 days began. The months were enlarged into what they called katuns, which lasted 7,200 days, and into even larger units of time, which they called baksun. And those were days, shall we say, of 144,000 days made of baksun. So according to the Mayan calendar, very carefully worked out and very complex, after the 13th baksun of 144,000 days was ended, the fourth age would begin, and the fifth age would begin. The fourth age would end and the fifth age would begin. So the dawn of the winter solstice of the year 2012 for the Mayans was the end of the fourth age and the beginning of the fifth age. Their impeccable, thank you, Gary, would you mind getting me a glass of water also? Their impeccable work cannot be said in any way to be shallow or meaningless or faddish. This prediction system has been set in place since ancient times. And as far as the Mayans and the South American Indians in general are concerned, it's just the way things are. The extreme unusualness of this day has to do with the fact that on the winter solstice of 2012, something will happen that has not happened for thousands and thousands and thousands of years, and that is that the galactic core will line up with Earth's sun. And Terence McKenna has a novelty theory. This novelty theory is just fascinating, and I have enjoyed studying it as I prepared for this talk. I wasn't aware of it until I wondered, well, just how many people did predict 2012, and how much of those predictions are worth talking about? Because there are literally hundreds of such predictions, but I combed through them to give you a few that might be more interesting for you to study further upon. And this Terence McKenna theory is very interesting because his basic theory, the novelty theory giving it away, is that the more unusual, rare, or novel a situation is statistically, the more likely it is to produce amazing and novel results. And to McKenna, the coincidence of the winter solstice and the heliacal rising of the galactic center is exponentially more novel than anything that has happened within the history of this planet, the written history of this planet at this time. We may have lost some records from ancient civilizations we don't know about, but of the records we have, this is the most novel point since the beginning of recorded history, 12, 21, 12. So he speculates that something might happen, such as an encounter with transdimensional objects, the end of time as we know it, the explosion of our sun, or the quasar ignition of the galactic core, which would be a really big explosion. And he doesn't know. He's really groping here for what kind of fantastic event could possibly be a genuinely authentic reaction in terms of the magnitude of the event to honor that degree of novelty. So he is a very interesting person to look at as far as 2012 and can give you some new insights. It did me anyway. I recommend it. His name is spelled T-E-R-E-N-C-E and M-C-K-E-N-N-A if you want to do a word search on him on the net. The Christians, of course, had the theme of the end of the world and Armageddon and the rapture and ascension woven deeply, especially into the New Testament. But if you read the Old Testament, there are many prophecies there concerning the end days also. And the theory or the theme of both Old and New Testament is repent and return. Or else, you know, is the unspoken dot, dot, dot. And I have to say that the way I look at the writings of Jesus and John the Baptist on this point, Jesus and John the Baptist can be considered really as a unit talking about the last days, because it was Jesus' cousin, John the Baptist, who began the preaching of repent and return at a very primitive level of being literally washed in the water, and as when rising up from the water, a whole new life was begun. And when Jesus began his ministry, he also talked endlessly about the end of the age. He talked about the harvest being ripe and white in the field, and yet there were so few harvesters to harvest the crop, which I think is code for Jesus' concern that people haven't been waking up. And he's very upset and wanting people to wake up now, because he says, before you die in this lifetime, this will happen, so you must get ready. Well, I've noticed this all through my experience as both a student of channeling, as a psychic who gets little inklings, no psychic gets for me, but I get resonances and inklings, and I've noticed the time dilates in a way that is amazing. People who are inspired to prophesy or who, like Jesus, are concerned from their heart of hearts for the cause of love in this world, tend to think that it's going to happen now. It's so urgent, you know. And this was 2,000 years ago that Jesus was talking like this. And so I think it's really worth noting that when you are talking about non-physical events or events that are rooted in non-physical causes, the time factor is always crunched so that it may be a long time from now, but it feels like it's going to happen tomorrow. And of course, if you've ever had in your own life a really big event that you were concerned about, you think, well, how can I ever get ready? And the time crunches on you so that you feel like you're really pressed for time. And that, I think, is behind a lot of the feeling of being driven by an urgency in the parables and the speeches of Jesus the Christ. The unfortunate thing about Christianity and world religions in general is that they tend to be used by church elders whose goals are not entirely within the realm of being a spiritual help and support to their congregation. They are increasingly wrapped up in politics and the conservation of money so that they may, of course, survive in order that they may offer their services to the world. And increasingly, the energies that are so pure in the speaking of Jesus the Christ or Muhammad or any source for a religion like that become politicized. And certainly, Armageddon and the rapture have become heavily politicized in our modern day 21st century reality, where it is used as a kind of hammer to bludgeon people into conversion. You must convert because it's all going to end. And when it does, if you haven't, what do they say? They say, taking Jesus Christ as your personal Savior is the way these fundamentalist Christians say that. If you haven't done this, and thereby taken on all this heavy burden of dogma, thing after thing after thing that you're supposed to believe, then you have no hope of going to heaven. There is no continuum. Life comes to an end. There is no more experience. You either are taken up with the rapture or the ascension and are able to enter some heaven world, or you are doomed to gnash your teeth in hell forever. It's a black and white world for them. And they are very interested in proselytizing and winning the whole world to their belief system so that no one will be left out. A humorous artifact of this process is that in the Mormon Church, their concern for the souls of planet Earth is such that they are going about gathering all the information that they can gather about every person on Earth, that is genealogical in nature, because somewhere in their inspired writings, it is said that if one of the faithful knows about another person and has that name written down in the scrolls of the Mormon religion, then that person is saved by association. So the Mormons have gone about gathering many, many bits of genealogical information to the point where they're probably the premier genealogical resource on the planet. They have a huge database, and those friends of mine who have been involved in genealogy say that it's indispensable. You can't do without the Mormon information because they want literally to write down the names of everybody on the planet. It is both humorous and in a way laudable because they're not trying to proselytize necessarily in order to save them. They're just trying to get their names right. And other sects within the Christian religion are far less dainty about their belief systems. And I think the most pernicious part of this is that the Bible Belt type inerrantist fundamentalist religion have a tendency, certainly not across the board, but in some ways have a tendency to be entirely exclusive and say that if you don't believe my way, you're doomed. And they do this by getting larger and larger congregations together or groups of congregations together and then telling their congregations from the pulpit for whom to vote, because the person that is being voted for is considered by them to be a person that will further the proper policies of their church. So we are looking at a time here in America, at least, where the line between religion and politics has been severed to the most part, and religion has become quite politicized for these sects. It's a kind of dangerous association, and you see it too in the Roman Catholic Church, where the Opus Dei movement has been so powerful, and it too is heavily politicized, and one of its stated goals is to create a global government run by the Pope, the Catholic Church, and all of the totally well-meaning and benevolent fathers of the Church. Of course, they're still fathers of the Church. We don't have any sisters in the Roman Catholic Church that aspire to the priesthood. One of the things I most like about my own church, the Episcopal Church, is that they have resisted completely the teachings of St. Paul, who condemned priests to celibacy and women to a lower order within humankind forever, saying that women were not worthy, women were weak, and women could not be in any chancel ministry. So the Episcopal Church has Episcopal bishops. Indeed, it has a female presiding bishop. You know, the head of the church in America is a woman. And this is causing great consternation amongst the other nations within the Anglican Communion worldwide, because most of the rest of the world is still of the opinion that women should not be allowed in the chancel even to read the lessons or to be lay distributors of communion wine. It is threatening to split the church, but the Episcopal Church has a long, long history of tolerance, and I believe that this will not occur, because there's just too much history that all of the priests in our church share that says, no, you don't exclude people. No, you don't dismiss people because they don't have the same dogma you do. You come together as those who seek a mystery, and it's perfectly all right to have people that think different ways in your church. It's certainly a church in which I have been welcomed in an atmosphere concerning channeling in which very few churches would welcome me. I have been supported and loved and not been considered deviant or free, anything like that. So it's been a real blessing to me to have been born into this particular church, because I think for personalities like mine, church offers something that you don't get from a less organized kind of spirituality. Every 3 years, every lesson from the Bible, both Old and New Testament, that was considered, say, the pearl, the cream of the crop of that writing, is read to the congregation. And after a three-year period, it cycles back and begins all over. And so if you want to live a life in faith and have a rule of life, which includes attending church, then you are able to listen to the words in a huge database of the Bible over and over again as you yourself grow and change and become more than you were before, so that you keep hearing these possibly inspired words and having another chance to give yourself over to the contemplation of them and to ask yourself, well, where is the resonance in these words? What can I learn? And I think this repetition helps us in our spiral upwards, because we come around again to this material and are able once again to interact with it. My husband and I use the same policy in working with the Law of One material. He and I have a morning offering every morning, except Sundays when I go to church, so the morning offering is church. But Monday through Saturday of every week, we have a morning offering which starts us off for the day. And we read in the Bible until we're done with the Bible and then start over again. We read the Old Testament and the New Testament. So we're always getting novel combinations of thoughts from the Old and the New Testament. It's surprising how many times you have a theme in those two writings to kind of give you seeds for thought for the day. But at any rate, I can't say that the Christian religion has ever predicted overtly a time of the end of the world, except, of course, that Jesus predicted it really early, that he was way off. But if you go into the sites that talk about 2012 and play around with entry after entry after entry, you discover that this priest or that small group or this biblical scholar has uncoded the time of the end of the world. And again, so far, they've been massively wrong. But then that cannot keep us from looking at the rest of the data, which suggests times in the future. So if you want to look at the Christian part in predicting the end of the world, it's played a substantial part, not in selecting a particular date, but in setting us up for the expectation of an incredible shift in consciousness. Interestingly enough, the Quran, which shares a lot of material with the Old Testament and also shares the techniques of gematria, or the finding of codes, hidden codes in Bible verses, and creating information by decoding these Bible verses, has used these codes to come up with a date of ending of this world at 2280. Well, in the sweep of thousands and thousands of years, from 75,000 years to now, a difference between 2012 and 2280 is not that great. So I include that because I think it's in the same energy and is drawing from the same deep source within its members. Another source that was just absolutely fascinated with the end of the world was a 16th century mystic called Nostradamus. He wrote his predictions in poems, which are called quatrains, four-line poems, and they were heavily encoded, heavily shielded from literal meaning, so that people for hundreds and hundreds of years since the 16th century have studiously been decoding Nostradamus' prophecies. And although you don't really have too many obvious correspondences between the quatrains and a very easy interpretation, you have many interesting interpretations. And Nostradamus predicted two years in two different quatrains, according to different people that figured out, or hoped that they figured out, what his quatrain said. One of those years was 2004, which apparently is not accurate, and since we're in 2007. And the other one is some time from now, 3797. The Western astrology does not predict the end of the world in 2012, but it uses that 12-21-12, that 333 number, to define the end of the age of Pisces and the beginning of the age of Aquarius. This is classical Western astrology. It isn't something that is a fly-by-night or a Johnny-come-lately. Astrology has been a developed science for centuries, and certainly as far back as Babylon, astrological systems were being created. There are alternate astrologies in the East. The Oriental astrologies are very interesting also. but I am not familiar enough with them to tell you whether they predict the end of the world. I did not see any mention of those systems of astrology when I was looking through the web for possible things to share with you on this day. But that does not mean that it didn't happen, or that if we were sophisticated enough to study globally instead of to study within our little part of the world, we might not find correspondences there too. One source of very interesting information is the Great Pyramid at Giza. And scholars throughout the last 200 years or so especially have gone into a frenzy of measuring. And they have measured the height, the width, the circumference, the angles of the Great Pyramid, the inner measurements of the Great Pyramid, the halls and the chambers and so forth. And they have found these measurements to duplicate or to be able to be used to show such things as the Fibonacci sequence, the circumference of the world. It is said that some of these measurements indicate that they are pointing to Sirius, as to say, the people that were forerunners of Earth came from Sirius. It's a fascinating study, and is well worth your attention if you wish to follow it. One of the predictive systems of the Great Pyramid of Giza was developed by several different people, but the basic unit that they talk about and they use is called the pyramid inch or the sacred cubit. Well, the pyramid inch is an independently derived figure. It's derived from the measurements of the pyramid itself and not from somebody's opinion as to what an inch should be. So it's an internally generated measurement, and it is considered to be a measurement that is sacred by the Egyptians, and it was given to them by their gods, say. And this pyramid inch was so persuasive to scientists when the United States was trying to figure out whether to go metric or to keep the inches. It was very sort of the tipping information in deciding to retain the inch and the measurements to go along with that inch, rather than moving over to the metric system, because of the fact that this sacred cubit is only infinitesimally different than the English inch. So it was felt that it would be sacrilegious to stop using the inch for measurements. So we can still measure in inches now, and feet and yards and so forth, because of the Great Pyramid of Giza. But one thing that this pyramid inch was then developed to indicate by scholars who went to the pyramids with all their measurements there was that taking a certain point and moving to the end of that ability to measure, it seems to have indicated that there was a huge break in 1914 and nothing would ever be the same again. And then they continue measuring up until, what is the date? It's 2004, same date as another source, Nostradamus source, in saying that this is the beginning of a terrible period. And this is because the measurements cease, there's a gap, and then the measurements can begin again on the other side of the gap. So the gap begins in 2004, and it's picked up again in 2032. Now, this seems to go along pretty much with other sources like the Confederation, with which I am familiar, in saying that there will be a penumbra, like the shadow under a tree. There will be a time when this tomorrow tree is shading the transition between third density and fourth density, and will come out the other side of it into a more simple and less complex world situation in about the year 2032. And I think that's really an interesting suggestion, because like the Confederation channeling, it doesn't say the world ends. it says there will be a time of trial, and then things will move right along. I think that that's a very helpful way to look at it. So, this 12, 21, 12 day is that which is caught the buzz, and yet that which is very worthy of respect and of investigation by us. The quote says, "The Mayans are among those civilizations which became aware of a cycle that stretched across long eras of your time. They saw that the planet itself would move through a very decisive change from the age of Pisces to the age of Aquarius. The age of Pisces is at its end. The age of Aquarius is in its dawn. Energies are shifting, and the time of energy to be as it has been for thousands of your years is rapidly coming to a close. That time will end during what this instrument calls the winter solstice of the year 2012. We would ask each who reads or hears our statement to pause at this time with us and release all fear. I'm sure you've noticed how fear-based many of our energies in society are these days. I think it's very difficult to release all fear. The only way that you can release fear is to turn decisively away from the outer picture and to call upon your faculties of faith and will. But it can be done. I think that if you look at the dynamics that shape our planet, one of the biggest dynamics is the dynamic between fear and love. It's like darkness and light. Fear is endlessly contracting, endlessly enfolding, and in its energy, because of its fear, it will do whatever it has to do to feel less fearful. So it becomes very violent and destructive. Whereas love drives out fear and makes one not unable to respond to difficult situations, certainly, but able to deal with difficult situations with compassion, sense of humor, and practical ways of dealing with what's in front of us rather than terrible imaginings of what might be and then scrambling in panic to have a more secure state. But perhaps it might end in 2012. Let's look at that. If it doesn't end in 2012, we live until the end of our lives and then we die. If it does end in 2012, that's our time to pass on. Now, we all know that we're going to die. I do not see the fear factor in contemplating the possibility of a worldwide change for all the inhabitants die at once. I do see long lines at St. Peter's Gate, and I hope and do not feel that it's going to happen that way. I have no resonance with that at all within myself. And as I said, I'm a psychic who has no psychic gifts, no good stuff, nothing outer. But I get these resonances. I get these inklings. And they usually turn out to be right. And my path of resonance on this subject has been, as long as I can remember thinking about Armageddon and the predictions in the Bible, that it wasn't accurate, that there was maybe something metaphysical could go on, that the world would wag on. But say that I'm wrong. If I'm wrong, then we all get to move on to a larger and more interesting environment at the same time. There would be really no such bad thing about that. I don't fear death myself. I died when I was 13, and I had a marvelous experience at that time, where I was in a beautiful place, and I heard a voiceover saying, well, we don't usually do this, but you just picked a very hard incarnation, so I'll give you a choice. You can go ahead and die, and then you can reincarnate again twice before the end of the age, once to do half of the things that you put on your plate as far as your service to the world, and then to die and then be born again and do the second part of your service to the world. Well, you know, at 13, I'd made it most of the way through childhood, and mine had been a really tough and sticky childhood with a lot of pain, as most people's childhoods tend to be. And I thought to myself, man, two more childhoods, I don't think so. So I told the voiceover I wanted to come back and see if I could get it all done with one incarnation. So frail of body and always in the guarded health. Ever since then, I now have reached the exalted age of 64, and I'm here to tell you I'm really, really glad that I decided to come back. So I don't fear death. If people really grasp the reality of the death process, I'm afraid the suicide rate would go up, because a lot of people are in desperate depression, having to do with other personal problems or having to do with their concern about the ways of the world. But we really came here to make a difference here, not to look at it and go, oh dear, and remove ourselves from the environment. So we need to be stalwart and of good courage at this point and realize that we came here to do this work together. And this is the perfect time to do it, no matter how interesting or challenging it might come to be. But what happens if we all die in 2012? Or in general, what happens when we die? The Confederation has an interesting way of looking at that. They say that we are in our energy body, using the whole energy body in this life experience, and this energy body is connected to our physical body by a silver cord. And when we die, the silver cord detaches. The body becomes a husk. We, the fruit within, are set free. We are ripe. We're ready to be plucked. And we are plucked up through our indigo and then our violet ray bodies through the gateway to intelligent infinity. And we reappear on the other side of that gateway in our energy body, presenting ourselves to the steps of light. We walk the steps of light when we die. This is not so much that which occurs in the midst of third density, but we are at the end of third density. This will be our last third density incarnation. We might come back with third density, fourth density, dual activated bodies, but this is our last pure third density incarnation. So we all will walk the steps of light when we die. These steps of light are described by those of Ra as being graduated steps, so that this step has a certain amount of light, the next step up the intensity of the light to include more light, more different kinds of light. The next step has a more information packed into the light, not a brighter light in the sense of being strong, but in the sense of being more packed full of information. Third density can only bear a certain amount of density of information or density of light. So that the word density has to do with how much light is packed into light, how much information is packed into each piece of light, if you will. So these steps of light go from third density into fourth density and move on a ways into fourth density, as I understand it, and out of sight. So the graduation process, which is guarded by beings and made sure that the vibrations of each step are completely accurate, you simply walk into the light. And when you can't take any more light, you stop because you're uncomfortable. And that's where you need to be. Then, after that, you get off the steps of light and you find out whether you're still in third density or whether you've graduated. It's not a process where God in white robes judges you. You sort yourself out by the light that you can bear. And, of course, you develop your ability to bear the light by witnessing to the light that you know while you're here in third density. So it's entirely in our hands whether we're going to graduate or not. If we want to polarize service to others, we lighten and lighten our consciousnesses until we are service to others oriented and we've graduated. When we go, we walk up the steps of light and we're in fourth density with its wonderfully more full information, no veil, retention of free will, but free will with full knowledge, so that our free will can be used much more effectively in determining what's the most skillful way to go forward, how do I really want to serve, and so forth. The people that are still in their density on these steps of life go through a period of healing, and then they are taken as souls, as the energy, to another planetary third density cycle, which is the beginning, or perhaps is in progress, where they continue to learn the lessons of love. That is the Confederation view of death and rising again, and it has nothing to do with saviors, except that the way that you work towards graduation in this idea of how things work is to save yourself, in that you give yourself the saving grace of forgiving yourself and always giving yourself another chance, so that you always have a new morning, you always have a new day, you can always start again. And this blessing is a tremendous one, in that it internalizes all of the energies of redemption and forgiveness and new life within our system, within our personal control, so that we may choose the manner of our being now and in the life to come. I believe that we're winding down for this first 45-minute segment. How many? 7 minutes? Oh, okay. We're not. We have a little bit of time left. So we will move on to what the Quo said in 2003 about graduation. As each entity reaches the point of leaving the earth plane through the normal processes of what you would call death, there is the opportunity at this time to graduate from third density and move into the fourth density, in what is often called ascension. In this process of ascension, the soul energy that is you, the essence of you, takes up a fourth density body for its next incarnation, and therefore takes up a whole different environment with a whole new set of lessons. I really look forward to this event in my life, and yet I don't want to leave third density until all my work is done. So I am hanging on with everything I have and praying for longevity, because this is the most critical and fascinating and challenging period of life we could ever have been born into. Ours is a much more intense experience than anyone else has ever had the privilege of experiencing. We can look forward, and we have already been in the midst of a tremendous time of the Earth moving with some difficulty into its fourth density beingness. What causes the Earth to be so difficult at this time? Well, if you had entities on your skin who kept banging at each other and banging at each other, you'd begin to get irritated on your skin, right? You feel it's like a rash of this aggression on your skin. And then you have people that disrespect the Earth, use the Earth as if it were not alive. And this has deeply wounded the Earth. That I know, and that we started our Gaia meditation in 2001 because a person who I trusted to have good psychic intuition told me that our planet was on the verge of refusing to speak to us anymore. It's just going to sever the connection and leave us to ourselves because of the fact that it was being ramped up endlessly as to how much we could abuse the planet, how we could rape it in a way that made it impossible for the Earth to sustain its people. And this grieved the heart of planet Earth to the point where they simply weren't going to talk to us anymore. They weren't going to be with us in covenant anymore. We did not want to share our energy. And because I felt that this really resonated to me, because I'd observed how very much we have gotten away from seeing us ourselves as stewards of Earth, and seeing ourselves simply as those who ravaged the Earth. So we began daily meditations each evening for Gaia, for the planet, for Terra, whichever you want to call her. And since August of 2001, we have never missed a day of the Gaia meditation. And as that has been seen on our website and in my discussion through the years, we've picked out people all over the globe that now join us in these meditations. We really recommend to you the concept of writing into us at LNL Research if you know of a group who is holding meditation on behalf of planet Earth. And we would like very much to create one of those global maps where people who have meditations that are of a group nature can write in, explain the meditation, and place it on the map so that people can enter into any number of these group meditations, such as the Fire the Grid effort recently. We have not gotten that up yet. It's always easier to have an idea than to prosecute an idea. But certainly hundreds and hundreds of groups around the world are now stepping up to the plate and saying, yes, we do need to do something, and we as a group can make a difference. And so the energies of meditation and healing for this planet have really been increased substantially in the last, I'd say especially the last 5 years. But I began with the channeling and with dealing with the information that the channeling produced back in 1962. And I really think that there's been an exponential increase in people, just regular people like you and I, who awaken and who realize, you know, we can do something not on the level of politics or on the level of overt activism, what marching and protesting, but we can offer our prayers, our visualizations, our intentions, our firm intentions to make a new life. And in this wise, I think I would like to end this segment by telling you about a book called Handbook for the New Paradigm. In it, this wonderful channeling source, which is anonymous, talks about how we all can make a difference by beginning to think in a new way. We can't repair the old paradigm. It's broken. It's not important. It's a goner. You can't put Humpty Dumpty back together again. But that's not important because third density is exhausted. It is in its, literally its last days. What we need to do is create the fourth density paradigm together by living by fourth density values. And in that, we have the control to do that. And we have the material before us in which to practice it. Every time we communicate with each other, every time we serve on committees or try to make a difference in our spirituality, we are becoming something that we were not before. And that is the prayer with which they suggest we live our lives. And that prayer is, I am a human being. Help me to become. I want a 15-minute break now, because I thought that over 2 hours was just too long to sit. So we will reconvene at 3:20, and please be here like at 3:18 and stuff, so that I'm not sitting here going, I don't want to start yet because I'd be talking to nobody. I mean, the audience on the radio is valuable, but... And then, console them to love them. Then we will begin receiving an enormous and ongoing harvest of those who want to love us, support us, encourage us, console us, and so forth. It is sort of an outgrowth of that statement, where is the love in this moment? Often the love begins with us, at least as we perceive it. So becoming able to graduate is a matter of daily, hourly, and momentarily focusing on who we are and why we're here and remembering that we are agents of love, love unlimited, love unconfined by convention or judgment or pretext, love for love's sake. absolute, utter, unconditional love. And when we realize that we have this capacity within us to move the focus of our attention from ourselves and our seeming lack to those around us and how we might be able to be part of the love in their lives, it puts us into an entirely different vibration, and it will always stand us in good stead as far as playing this game of life. And this is the book that I'm writing right now. I'm trying to write it so that absolutely anybody can understand it, which is not true necessarily of my other work. The channeled works from the Ra group are very dense. It's sort of in places like reading German philosophy, especially Kant, where there is a very dense degree of information in each paragraph, and it takes a while even to read a paragraph. So if you read the raw material, you may want to stop at half a page or two pages or wherever it is that your mind realizes it's on overload and says, stop, let me consider this further. So it may take a while for some to read this kind of philosophy, and it also has the characteristic of making up words. For instance, to the Ra group, a person was a mind-body-spirit complex. Well, why in the world didn't they just say person? Because in the fine tradition of German neologism used in philosophical systems, they needed all of those components to describe a person. So when they say mind-body-spirit complex, that means that they're saying that a person is a mind complex, a body complex, and a spirit complex, all wrapped into one human being. So we have a much more complex and accurate understanding of the kind of being that we are and what we have to work with. And this runs through the raw material. And you know, in my second generation of attempting to offer the principles of the Confederation of Philosophy to people, I wrote the Wanderer's Handbook in 2001 because so many of the people that respond well or resonate to the Law of One material by Ra are wanderers. Ra talked about wanderers a good bit in the sessions with Don Elkins asking the question and me being the channel. And I myself am a wanderer, so I thought that it was good to make a handbook. So what I wanted to do was answer all the questions that were raised by the people in about a 10-year period of my answering email from people asking about the Law of One. And I gathered together about 120 questions that were the frequently asked questions. And then I wrote an essay on each of those questions. And I did it in such a way that you could read the essays as a book, or you could just look up your problem in the table of contents, target it, and read that particular essay. I thought that most people would either use a Wanderer's Handbook, which is quite large and long and rich, full of information, in that way, so that it was like a user's manual. And you could look up, well, gee, how do I work this gizmo that I've discovered in my personality or in my practice? How do I attack that? How do I approach that? But in fact, I understand over and over again people have been saying, no, I read it all the way through. So you can use it that way. You can use it also as an I Ching. Are you familiar with the I Ching prophesying thing where you take 6 coins and you shake them and you scatter them and you count the succession of heads and tails on the coins, and then you look up the hexagram that arrangement of heads and tails for yes and no or whatever offers you, and then that arrangement is a certain I Ching, and you read a little paragraph of discussion of what your situation is metaphysically. Well, I thought that you could also use a Wanderer's Handbook that way. Open the book at random, put your hand down on the page, and read what you're looking at. And I have done this myself through the years with tremendously good results. You can also do that with the Bible, for instance. Anyway, I understand from reactions of people who have told me they can't read that book that I still was writing to the chancel, not to the congregation. I was writing for people who were already into metaphysics and had a lot of experience in reading metaphysics. And I wasn't writing for the person who says, I wonder what this is all about, and they just pick up a book. I wanted a truly introductory book, and I wanted it to consist of a curriculum. So I decided that I would write three books, and I'm still on the first one now, but hopefully I'm towards the end of it. The first one is The Choice, and I talk about, really, I give the awakening spirit who's coming into the emergency room of, oh my heavens, now that I'm awake, I see all that I have to do, what do I do first? What am I going to do? So this book takes you into the principles of Log One, and I developed the idea of life as a game. I don't mean to say that it's a shallow game, but I do mean to say that it is a game like any other. And it has its rules, and it has its winning and losing choices, and it has its sportsmanship. It has everything that you could use in a game, and at the same time, it's a quick way to organize one's thoughts on how you use the material practically. So that is the first volume, and the second volume will be on the outer world, the issues of the first three chakras, so relationships, sexuality, home, family, work, all of those difficult questions, you know, suicide, abortion, what's the real nature of marriage, what's the real nature of mating, what is the situation, how do you problem solve and troubleshoot using the Confederation principles in dealing with the outer world. And the third volume is going to be 103, The Inner Work, and I will then talk about the resources that we have in the upper chakras for working consciousness, for raising our vibrations, so that as we meet our issues in the outer world, we can increasingly alter and enhance our attitude, the attitude with which we've come to these seeming challenges. So it is a beau geste that I'm very much enjoying working on. But it all has to do with a change or a shift in one's point of view. The way that you graduate is to alter your point of view so that the way that you are approaching life is a way that is conducive to living in a world that is, for you, for your inner world, 51% or more service to others. And there are certain things about this attitude that I can say in very short words. One is thanksgiving and gratitude. If you can approach a situation in terms of thanksgiving, I give thanks that I have this situation, you're not being ridiculous. You're not being silly to give thanks in the face of a challenge. Because, as Ram Dass said so eloquently years ago, it's all grist for the mill. If you didn't have these problems, if you didn't have these slaps in the face, if you weren't persecuted for one reason or another, if you didn't have fears and trembling, what would you work with? How would you progress? How could you work the puzzle of life? How could you follow the maze? You have to have a lot of dead ends. You have to make a lot of mistakes. You have to go through a lot of difficult changes in order to shake out the old from your habits and to form new habits. People that awaken are faced with a tremendous learning curve, and that learning curve is not found in books necessarily. You can read books and find out more about how to approach being awake and improving upon that awakening. But really, the work that you do where the rubber really hits the road for a seeker is within himself. All the information in the world stays right up here in your head. And you're using your brain, and your brain is all about me. We can't help being made that way. We are the center of our universes. So when we approach problems analytically or with logic, it's from the me mind. It has to be, because that's the mind that analyzes and uses consensus reality, facts, and assumptions in order to solve problems. But the way fourth density suggests that we solve problems is from the we mind of the heart. there is a whole different mind than we are aware of. And we think we just have a mind, but that's not true. We have two of them. We have our intellect and we have our insight. Our intellectual mind is a very useful pack animal, and we can work it hard and it will serve us well, but we have to guide that mind. We cannot be driven by our mind, or we will forever be lost in what if and should I and so forth. We need to release our complete dependence upon the intellectual mind and realize that there is another mind, and that is the mind of the heart. And when we use the mind of the heart, we're using our intuition, our insight, that gnosis, that is that wonderful word, G-N-O-S-I-S, gnosis, which is Greek for knowing, but it's a different kind of knowing. It's the knowing that comes bursting forth from within and lets you know that you're on the path of the greatest resonance. And when we begin to combine those two ways of thinking so that we approach our challenges not only with our intellect, but also giving full value of insight to the mind of the heart, then I think we really have begun to shift our point of view. And as the Ra group said, the source of all distortion is the limitation of the viewpoint. So if we can widen and deepen our viewpoint, if we can find a higher viewpoint to stand upon where we can look out over a larger geography of possibilities, then we begin to become confident and even skillful at putting together the jigsaw puzzle of life, even when we have missing pieces, because we use our intuition and our insight to supply guesses about how to fill in those missing pieces. And once we are looking for the pattern as a whole, then we are much more capable of change. And that's the thing about becoming able to graduate into fourth density. It requires us to transform. Now, you know, if you've ever tried to change a habit, that it's very difficult to change a habit. It takes, I understand, 3 weeks to change a habit. But you have to keep on for 3 weeks before you even begin to stop thinking, oh, I want to do it that way, and replace that with a new habit. Oh, no, this is the way I do it now. Also, if you've ever changed jobs, changed mates, changed cities in which you live, you know how vastly uncomfortable and tension-making that change can be. And what you're asking of yourself when you wake up and say, I want to increase my awareness, I want to know the truth, I want to know the infinite creator, I want realization, you're asking yourself to go through a tremendous amount of change and transformation. And involved in that change is tearing down or the gently releasing of the old edifice of self so that a new building can be built of new thought and new ways of doing things. That's why I think the prayer, I am a human being, help me to become, is so powerful. Because it doesn't refer to religion, it doesn't refer to any particular way of thinking, it simply says the truth. Here I am. I want to be more than I am. Help me. Who are you talking to? It doesn't matter. One time, years and years ago, my mother asked me to help her in learning to pray. And I said, well, you know, prayer is just a conversation. Don't need to take anything away from Mr. Walsh, but prayer is just a conversation with God. So, talk to God. And she said, well, I don't know if I believe in God. I said, okay. Mom, how about talking to your bedpost? She slept in a four-poster bed. She said, talk to my bedpost. Are you serious? And I said, I certainly am. I said, when you have something on your mind, tell it to the bedpost. About 2 weeks later, she came to me and she said, Carla, I don't believe this, but my bedpost is talking back to me. And from that point on, she was able to enter into prayer, knowing that the other, the beloved other, is waiting for us to engage it in conversation. It's not a matter of, there's a, you know, dear Lord and Heavenly Father, we praise and bless your holy name. You know, it's not a matter of going through a rote ritual of prayer. It's a matter of opening your budget, opening your heart completely, throwing yourself into the spotlight of truth and saying, Lord, here's the situation. I just don't know what to do about this. And then talking about the situation. Well, I often encourage people to keep a pen and a paper handy, because so often when you empty your heart like that and ask for help, you're instantly, you're starting to get thoughts. And if you write them down, you won't forget them. So it's really a good way to pray, is to pray with a journal at hand so that the utterings that come to you in answer to prayer are preserved, because they will leave you as soon as they came. But this is one part of forming yourself in such a way as to become liable to become a friendly place for transformation to occur. If you can look at all of these challenges that change causes in you, if you can look at the dark night of the soul or the purgative way and say, thank you for this dark night of the soul. Thank you for these very, very challenging emotions that I'm feeling, because I know that this is necessary for me to go through these times of darkness, to go through these times of the creation of fertilizer for the seeds of new thought within me, so that they may, in the light of the new dawn of a changed me, burst into bloom and become the way I am blooming in this world. What happens after 2012? That has been something that people have wondered about. What if we don't all get raptured away, or some of us go to heaven and some of us go to hell, or any of these scenarios that we hear so much about? Well, I don't think that's going to happen. I think that what happens after 2012, according to the Confederation, certainly, is that we are going to enjoy the time to make restitution to this planet. And it's very important that we do this because of the number of civilizations that have come to this reform school Earth. They've all blown up their planet or created a situation in which by radiation it was impossible to live on that planet in certain density. And so we have a tremendous group karma. The way to alleviate that karma is simply, in this lifetime, to begin to be stewards of the earth and stewards of each other instead of users of the earth and users of each other. So I think that there's going to be a good deal of energy where people are looking at the planet not as something to use but something to take care of and to restore. The quote says, many are the entities on your planet who have destroyed other planets, such as Mavic, Mars, other planets outside your solar system. We ask that you become more and more aware that you have the opportunity at this time, within this incarnation, to turn that energy within yourself around and to become stewards, loving and wise, of whatever little acre or square foot that you may have of planet Earth. Green living, of course, is all in the news these days. The recent, was it Earth Live? Is that Live Earth? Yeah, Live Earth. It was totally global and had so many wonderful personalities lending their celebrity and their creative gifts to the simple request of people to wake up and realize what the situation really is on planet Earth and how we can make a difference by such simple things as using the light bulbs that have coils, using the low-energy light bulbs, fluorescent light bulbs, rather than the traditional globe light bulbs, which draw so very much more energy and use it up. We can unplug our battery chargers so that unless we're actually charging the battery, you don't have the charger stuck in the wall. That saves a tremendous amount of energy. We can become aware of when we turn lights on and turn lights off. All of these things make the planet have more of their assets to share with more people. And we can do all of those simple things wherever we live, even if it's in a high-rise apartment with one room. We can put green plants into our atmosphere and increase the oxygen in our own environment so that we are in relationship with the real world. Even if our feet don't touch planet Earth, our hearts are touching planet Earth. Now, I think that there are many more people working on recycling and living green in Europe than there are in the United States. But I believe that it is catching on in the United States. We ourselves, my husband and I, are hoping one day to be able to afford to build a passive solar house on the Avalon property, most of which is leased to L&L Research itself for a spiritual center. But we sectioned off a bit of that acreage for ourselves, and we hope to be able to establish there not only living for ourselves, but also a place to hold conferences to talk more about the Law of One and to help people come together. And we are very interested in biodynamic farming and organic farming, because this is a beautiful translation of the principles of the Law of One, that we are all one and that everything is alive, into how you relate to your environment. So these are the energies that I personally have chosen to focus upon in living my life more as a steward of this earth. And we can do all of those things. The harvest, of course, is a rough transition this time, much more rough than it has ever been before. They've never seen anything like this. There are people all over the galaxy, not, of course, in our density, but from other galaxies. They're watching this with great interest because it's a completely unique experience. They've not seen this before. They've not seen 16 different planetary populations, all of whom were naughty in their last, except for the 150 people from our own planet who are of the elder race and who chose to return to help their brothers. Everyone has transgressed, and that's why they're here. So it really is a reform school. And it's amazing to watch the prejudice and the tensions between different groups flow, because it would stand to reason that you'd have some tension if you were dealing with someone from an entirely different ethos. And different planets have different logoi, and each logos creates its own archetypal mind. So you have 16 different archetypal minds trying to blend, and people don't want to blend. So they look at someone else's way of approaching life and say, well, that's really lesser than mine. If we could only embrace all of these differences instead of judging them, we'd be far closer to graduation as a tribe. And I still have this hope that somehow there will be a global uprising of people who want to embrace each other and to create an atmosphere in which we graduate as a planet. Ross said, the fourth density is, as we have said, as regularized in its approach as the striking of a clock upon the hour. The space-time of your solar system has enabled this planetary sphere to spiral into space-time of a different vibrational configuration. This causes the planetary sphere to be able to be molded by these new vibrations. Hence, the thought forms of your people during this transition period are such that the mind-body-spirit complexes of both individuals and societies are scattered throughout the spectrum instead of being able to grasp the needle and point the compass in one direction. Thus, the entry into the vibration of love or understanding is not effective within your personal present societal complex. The harvest shall be such that many will repeat the third density cycle. The energies of your wanderers, your teachers, and your adepts at this time are all bent upon increasing the harvest. However, there are few to harvest. In later channelings, the Quill Group has assured us that harvesting population is growing exponentially now as people are waking up and not wanting to go back to sleep. Now, they talked about your teachers, your adepts, and your wanderers. Teachers are pretty obvious. We have so many wonderful teachers in our literature and our religion. The adepts are not too obvious to some people, because there's a feeling that magic is a casting of spells and the manipulation of people by other people, but there is an ancient magical tradition upon this planet, which is sometimes called the white magical tradition. It has grown up in the West with acknowledged usages of concepts from the East, and it is not a secret society. It is not hidden on purpose. So because not too many people are interested in becoming magical, it's not very well known. But there is a brotherhood and sisterhood of adepts that has existed ever since the time of Hermes, and will exist as long as there are those who are called to become disciplined and magical and able to use their power rightly. and then to create ways to use that power. But the wanderers are, in many ways, the most powerful of the helpers that we have at this time. I consider myself to be a wanderer, and I think there are many millions and millions of wanderers all around the world. Now, wanderers are simply those that had home planets other than Earth. And then when Earth began to enter into the last of the years of third density and have such a woeful harvest, there really were too few to help in the harvest, and they decided to come and help in the harvest. They call themselves the Brothers and Sisters of Sorrow, according to the Ra group and Confederation in general. There are three generations, according to Kuo, of these wanderers. I am of the first generation. I and many others like me, millions like me, came to Earth in groups from either fifth density or sixth density, the densities of wisdom and the density of unity, because we wanted to risk it all. We wanted to take a gamble that we could help Earth lighten her vibration by the end date of this third density. And so we went through incarnational processes which robbed us of our memory of who we are, what our background was, and we entered into the incarnation where nothing is known, and we had to recapture our knowledge of who we were by faith alone. And so a lot of wanderers have not yet awakened because they have gotten so disgusted by Earth that all they want to do is leave it. They don't want to wake up and engage with it. They don't want to love it. They don't want to help it. They just want out. And, you know, here's a call to any wanderer listening who feels that way. Get a grip. It's time to realize who you are and to realize that you came here for such positive, such high-minded things. And it's time to be about your business. It's time to fulfill your mission. It's time to love everybody and let everybody love you. There's a saying in the South, I want you all to love on each other. Well, that's exactly what I'm saying. Love on each other. And let people love on you. You're worth it. You really are. You can take love. You can take compliments. I think it's almost harder to accept love of an unconditional nature than just to give it. So practice love. The second generation of wanderers is, I would say, typified by the me generation, although there were second generation wanderers before that, and there are second generation wanderers after that. But those were attracted to Earth not simply for high-minded helping others and damning torpedoes. It was more calculated. It was like, you know, in third density, I could get more balancing, rebalancing of my wisdom and my love, or my love and my power, or whatever. I could balance better in this boot camp than I could in 1,000 years of incarnation in this density. So I want to come down to third density again, enter the boot camp, and see if I can get myself in better settle. And so certainly they want to be of service to others. Higher densities always do. However, their first consideration is to work on themselves. So you'll see a good many self-involved people who are very high vibration and yet they don't seem to be very unselfish. And that is because they're having trouble breaking that me circle of personality and getting a wider picture where it's we instead of me. But these wanderers constitute a significant amount of the population of wanderers. The third generation of wanderers we have sometimes called indigo children or crystal children. And the basic situation with crystal children or indigos is that they have graduated. They've made it through graduation already. They've already died. They made graduation. They got to fourth density after an incarnational healing period. And having cleared that healing period and being free of any adhering karma, they now ask themselves, so, what do I want to do next? And they answer themselves to a man and woman, so I understand, by saying, just as the elder race did, all 150 of them that graduated in the first wave of the first minor cycle, they want to come back because they have brothers and sisters here on Earth, and they want to bring them with them when they all, so we can all graduate. So the crystal children are motivated very much towards problem solving, troubleshooting, busting systems that don't work, and in general starting novel ways of dealing with problems and seeing things in a wider perspective. It's kind of upsetting to many parents who are dealing with these wanderer children that they don't seem to behave properly. They don't obey unless it makes sense for them. And I say to all crystal children parents out there, don't tell them what to do. Ask them for help. Don't be authorities over them, but identify with their situation and explain to them what it is you need. For instance, don't tell them, do this or I will be angry. Tell them, Mommy needs a rest. I need a break, and I need you to do this to help me. Will you please do that? The difference between those two ways of dealing with your needs and the child's needs is amazing. I think that the third generation of wanderers is being extremely effective already. I recently wrote an article for UPI on one particular crystal child from Canada, Ryan Hoiljack, who found out at the age of 7 that people in Africa were dying for want of water. So he decided to raise what he thought was $2,000, the cost of a new well. And he mowed lawns, he washed windows, he did errands, and he earned the money and got his well. But they found out that $2,000 wasn't the actual price tag. It was actually much, much more than that, like $70,000. So he said, okay, I'll just keep on doing chores. But by this time, he had enough publicity that hundreds, thousands of people were giving donations to Ryan's well fund. So he created Ryan's Well Foundation, and to date they have put in hundreds of wells all over Africa from this little child. He is now 16, and what does he want to do? He wants to get his degrees and his credentials so he can go to Africa, and his goal is to make sure that there is no African child without water. And, you know, I have a feeling he's going to do it. It's we've got a 3-minute signal here, so I will wind up. Do you come from Mars? Do you come from Maldek? Do you come from Deneb? Were you in Mu? Were you in Atlanta? Atlantis? Where are you in this? You are all in the same place as me. You are the ambassadors for life on planet Earth, if you choose to be. We're all one tribe. It doesn't matter from whence we came. When we went through the incarnational process and were born into this valley of the shadow, we became a member of the tribe of planet Earth. We are human. And we together are a tremendous force for the good. So I would suggest to everyone that we begin thinking about how to be secret agents. Because you can't simply go about trying to proselytize unconditional love. You can't convert people. People convert themselves. What you have to do is live in such a way that people come to you and say, how are you doing this? What's your secret? Or in any way asking you to open your heart and talk to them freely and openly. And in this way, you can continue communicating and dropping seeds. You know, that's the thing. You don't have to be heavy-handed about this. You never push your ideas on people if you want to be a secret agent. That would blow your game, wouldn't it? What you want to do is be like a Johnny Appleseed of thought and look for the opening. Look for the possibility of a communication, an energy exchange between you and another person where you're not over and above them telling them what to do. You're saying, well, that's really an interesting thought. You know, I had that thought. And when I've had that thought, my reaction has been to, and then you give the same thought, to give love, to give light, to be compassionate, to forgive yourself. There are so many ways to talk about unconditional love. And I hope that you will all be agents for unconditional love and do random acts of kindness. And be very happy with yourself, because as you put that radiant light out there, as you become a beacon and a lighthouse, letting that light shine through you. You are changing the world. Work on yourself, work on the world. At this time, with our minutes dwindling, I shall leave the radio audience in love and in light, with great thanksgiving and joy to have been able to talk to you at DBS Radio. We will continue here for some time to come. Farewell from Carla and from all of those connected with this wonderful gathering at Mackinac Island in the summer of 2007. May you go well, and God bless.